Now we're focused on hip and knee replacements. According to a study published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, over 7 million Americans are living with a hip or knee replacement. And the number of these joint surgeries is expected to grow significantly in coming decades. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Dr. Jonathan Webb is an orthopedic surgeon at Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire, where he specializes in revision, total hip and knee replacements, orthopedic trauma, and osteoarthritis. Dr. Webb, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning to you and your listeners.
Good morning. Well, first be a tour guide, if you will, and we're going to start with the hip. Can you explain the anatomy of the hip and how it functions?
Definitely. So the hip joint, similar to the shoulder joint, is a ball and socket joint. And like any of the joints that we talk about, has a cap of cartilage that is on either side, or each part of the bones has a cap of cartilage that moves against one another, almost like the tread on our tires. And they function with the muscles and tendons around to provide us the wide range of functions that our hip provides.
The hip being one of the most stable joints in the body, what causes it to deteriorate to a point where it's an issue or that it needs replacement?
So there's a lot of different diagnoses that can result in hip replacement surgery. The most common is osteoarthritis, or kind of more degenerative or wear and tear arthritis, like most people will hear about. And there are a number of causes of osteoarthritis. The main one is genetics. And many of your listeners may say, hey, I've got a sister, a brother, a aunt, uncle, parent that had hip replacement or bad arthritis. And so it may run in families. Other issues may be injuries that patients have had over the years, excessive wear or overuse. And there's, again, a slew of other causes that might result in hip replacement surgery.
When someone's hip is unstable or is in a position to be a candidate for hip replacement, what does the pain threshold look like? What type of pain is that patient experiencing?
Every patient experiences pain differently. And that's the great part about my job, is that I get to see and take care of a whole number of patients that come from a variety of different areas. But typically the pain is related to pain in the groin, onto the side of the hip, or even into the buttock. It typically is worse with activities, either standing, walking, stairs, or things of that nature. And really, when it gets to the point that it's bad enough to consider surgery, is when that pain and that dysfunction start to impact a patient's life enough that a surgery seems like a reasonable thing to do. And the things that it can impact are, you know, sometimes patients say that I just can't do things with my grandkids anymore, or I can't sleep well at night and it keeps me up. Those types of things are important to patients, and that's where hip replacement surgery may be an option for them.
Let's bring on a caller now. Sean in Onalaska, they had hip replacement, I think, in your 50s, Sean?
Yeah, I had my hip replaced at age 50. I'm 52 now. And it was because of the arthritis. The imaging had showed that I whatever, the above the ball there, that cartilage was very worn away and there was very little space there. And I had situations where I would walk a block and then wonder how I was going to get the next two blocks with, because the pain was so excruciating. So I did have the hip replacement. And I'll first of all say that once you have a joint replaced, do the physical therapy, get it prescribed to you. For me, it wasn't prescribed to me. I mean, I did some therapy at the hospital, but then after that, I was kind of left to my own devices. I wish I'd done physical therapy, because I think I've lost some muscle mass, because the way they went in, I don't know if this is done any different way, but they cut a muscle along the side of my hip. And, you know, I always use the hip adductor machine and all other hip exercises now, but I think that period right afterwards
was crucial.
Is crucial. And I have one question too, and that is, I want to get back to running possibly, but then people are telling me, well, with a hip replacement, then my mind is on the right. So like my right knee, there'd be more wear and tear on my right knee. And then maybe I'd wear out the joint too quickly? Am I too old to run, or what's the doctor's thinking on that?
Sean, thank you. Yes, thank you for sharing your experience, Dr. Webb.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I get that a lot. You know, these replacements can tolerate a lot, and certainly activities are what we want our patients to do afterward. That's why we're doing these operations. But just like any sort of part on your car, for instance, like your brakes, the more you kind of beat them up, the maybe sooner they're going to need more surgery or more stuff done to them. And so with running, even though an implant can tolerate that, it's probably not the best type of activity for the longevity, especially given your young age. But you have to kind of balance that out with what is best for you as far as your health and your overall happiness is, because we want you to be happy. We want you to be functional in the long term. And so if, you know, jogging here and there helps you, you know, that you kind of have to weigh those risks and benefits and talk to your surgeon.
What might be some better exercise options than running?
Some lower impact activities that are really good. Biking is an extremely good exercise for any sort of joint replacement, hip or knee. Swimming, if you're a member at a gym, using an elliptical or a stationary bike or something like that. Those lower impact activities give you a lot of overall physicality and some strength and other sorts of benefits from a cardiovascular standpoint, but put less wear and tear on the actual metal and plastic or ceramic and plastic joint that may be used.
Sean, thank you for the call. We have orthopedic surgeon Jonathan Webb of the Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire, our guide to hip and knee replacements. We're going to get to the knee here in just a moment. Join in with questions on these joints, the severity of hip and knee pain, the outcome you had with one or both of these surgeries, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Webb here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing hip and knee replacement, a couple of the most common operations performed in orthopedic surgery. It's an hour in your health here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the Mayo Clinic, both hip and knee replacement have high rates of success, and implants used in joint replacements often last for decades. Join in on what you've experienced, 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Jonathan Webb, an orthopedic surgeon at Mayo in Eau Claire, fielding your questions for the hour. Dr. Webb, let's touch base here on knee anatomy. How does the knee function compared to the hip joint?
So like I mentioned for the hip, just like the hip, the knee has three bones actually that are articulating one to one another, and they all have cartilage that are rubbing on one another to provide the best function that the knee can provide. Unlike the hip, however, the knee is much more complicated, and it's like a hinge, but has some rotation and some bending. And so it's a little bit more complicated given the number of bones and the actual motion that it entails. It also has a lot more ligaments and has some alignment differences that some patients will notice that change over time with wear and tear.
What might it be like for someone whose knees are not working properly? How limiting is this?
It can be quite debilitating. I mean, a lot of patients will have difficulty getting up and down stairs, or will even have difficulty getting out of a chair and feel like they just can't, what they'll say, quote unquote, trust their leg. And like it's going to give out on them. And that they, a lot of times we're doing these surgeries because patients have safety concerns about their ability to ambulate or do the things they need to do in life. They also may notice some decreased range of motion of the knee that makes doing a lot of things like putting on and off their socks, putting their shoes on, changing, very difficult to do.
Chris in Chippewa Falls with us, both knees replaced last year. Chris, go ahead.
Hello, this is Gary.
Gary, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Gary.
Yes, I had one done in September of last year and then the other one done this March. One of the things that kind of bothered me, especially after the first one. I mean, I went into these and I rode bike and I really did a lot of exercise, and I'm almost 70 years old. So I really kept my legs strong, and they said that would help me in my recovery. The one thing that they don't prepare you for is how doggone painful this is. Mm. I mean, it's 2 or 3 weeks of really, you know, a lot of drugs. And, you know, my wife had to go, I couldn't hardly get out of bed. And you're only in the hospital for one day. Seems like 24 hours and you're gone in both my knees. And I think that's one of the things is that I wish, because I thought I was like me. It's like, I'm crazy here. It's like, I thought, jeepers, you know, what's going on? I'm not recovering like I should.
Gary, how are you today?
Well, my last one was done March 7th on my right side, on my left knee. And that one was not as bad as my right knee.
Okay.
And it's coming back. I mean, I've still got issues. I've still got pain and stuff. I'm done with therapy. But, I mean, it's recovering. I mean, I know it is. I mean, it's getting better. But, wow, I mean, it's a pretty tough road. And I think people need to know that. I mean, I think doctors are afraid to tell people that, thinking that they're going to not do the surgery. I mean, I didn't have a choice. My knees were actually off center about 3/8 of an inch, both of them, where they had slid to the inside.
Mm. Gary, thank you. Dr. Webb, this is a long, tough road to recovery.
It definitely is. And Gary, I'm glad that you're on the road to recovery. And certainly these are painful surgeries. And you're right. We need to make sure that patients are as prepared as they can be for the operation that we're giving to them. Every patient experiences these operations a little bit differently. Some, you know, may have it a little bit easier. Some struggle with pain a lot. And that's a difficult balance to try to make sure that we're educating patients well enough that they're prepared for this. Knee surgery, if we're talking knees and hips today, knee surgery is by far much more difficult and much more painful than hip surgery. And so it is a longer road. There's a lot more recovery and therapy that's involved. I do think that we have made good strides in our ability to manage some of these surgeries with pain medicines, but it does take a great team in order to make sure that that happens. And it takes the patience of patients to get through this and have a great outcome.
Do you see those great outcomes? I mean, have you made strides in the direction of a lot more mobility for these patients post-surgery?
I think we have. You know, when we're talking about knee surgery, there's been multiple studies that show significantly improved outcomes for patients. 85 to 90% of patients will have those extremely good outcomes or very good outcomes. But, you know, some people afterward, no matter what we do, still have some things about their knee that may not be perfect or feel perfect. And so we're still trying to hone in, how do we improve all that with either technology, with implants, with the way in which we recover. And so, you know, I do think that there are going to be people that are going to feel like this is a much more difficult thing than they thought going into it. But I do think, and hopefully this is true for Gary with his first knee, and, you know, maybe further down the line for the second knee, that he feels like it was worth it in the long run.
Dr. Jonathan Webb with us with the Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire, an orthopedic surgeon fielding your questions on hip and knee, 800-642-1234. Joan is joining us from Superior. Joan, hi, what's your story?
Hi, I have a left knee that is really messed up. I started with a knee replacement, which was wonderfully perfect. Very little pain. I was a star in physical therapy, could do everything. 7 weeks out, my quadriceps tore. Mm. And that just messed everything up. I've had 2 revisions on trying to get my tendons together, and I'm still lamer than I was before I had knee surgery. My big question is, I don't know if I need to get a third opinion. One doctor wants to do a tibular-tubular osteotomy, and the other one, because my kneecap sits way off to the side of my leg, and the other one wants to do a total knee replacement and try to rebuild the tendons again. And it's like, if I'm going to do this, I want something this time that's going to work.
Joan, thank you. Dr. Webb, what would you say in this situation?
You know, revision surgery, and that's one area of special interest to me, is very difficult and not something, as Joan is saying, you can really take lightly. It is something where it can have great outcomes, but it can also be devastating when patients' knees or hips are not functioning the way that they want. I think the number one thing that I tell people that I see that have something where I might recommend revision surgery or that are seeing me for another opinion is, I don't think that there's ever too many opinions that you can get, because I think you really want to be the most educated that you can when it's something this significant. And so whether it's seeing, you know, somebody outside of that area, or looking at the background of the people that you're seeing and make sure that they have a strong enough background in the revision world, because it is a niche world and it is something that requires a bit of extra training to make sure that you have better outcomes for patients.
What does revision surgery mean?
That's a very wide range is what revision covers. Revision can be something as simple as going back into a knee and maybe changing out a piece of the plastic that acts as a cushion between the two components otherwise, mm-hmm. or it could mean removing everything and starting over. So there's a wide range of what revision could mean, and it all depends on what the indication for revision is. And that's going to be best discussed with the surgeon that you are seeing as far as what the actual problem with your knee might be.
Orthopedist Jonathan Webb of Eau Claire with Mayo Clinic Health System fielding all questions on hip and knee replacement. Join in on the procedure, what to expect, your outcome on the surgery, or what your family member experienced in recovery. 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Dr. Webb right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Now we're discussing hip and knee replacement surgery. These surgeries have the potential to renew a person's quality of life, to alleviate pain, allow for increased function of the joint. Join in with your questions, your experiences, implants versus revision surgery, recovery. 800-642-1234. Dr. Jonathan Webb, an orthopedic surgeon at Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire, with us for the hour. Dr. Webb, let's swing back here to the hip. And as we've been hearing with callers, there are different types of hip replacement surgeries, like total hip or partial hip, where only you're only replacing the ball. And then there's resurfacing, I understand. How do you determine which type is needed?
Yeah, that's a great question. We do lots of different operations to the hip. The vast majority of what your callers may have or experience or will find that they're discussing with their providers is a total hip replacement where the ball is removed and the socket side is replaced. These are typically done with a stem, which we call it, where it goes down into the femur, and then a socket side made of metal that has usually a plastic or metal lining, and then a different type of material for the ball. A partial hip replacement where just the ball is replaced and the socket side is left is typically used only in patients that have had certain types of hip fractures and maybe are a little bit more elderly. The resurfacing implants were used more broadly years ago. They still are used today. They are a metal on a metal implant where basically the ball is not removed of the hip and it's just capped with a metal implant. Again, they are still used. Some providers have gone away from it, concerns about the type of articulation, but it is still used and does have good function for the types that are done.
What concerns arise, what complications arise when your patient is quite elderly who has fallen and needs to address the hip?
It depends on the type of fracture that they have. Every type of fracture around the hip is treated a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. But the decision-making that we have for that is, again, the type of fracture and also the level of function that the patient has leading into it. The biggest challenge that we have with elderly patients that have hip fractures is really just what their medical issues are leading into that, because we can't change the fact that they have various medical issues and fell. We have to manage that fracture, but at the same time, balance the risk that they may have due to underlying heart conditions, pulmonary conditions, or other things of that nature.
Let's bring on Saul now in Stevens Point. Saul, hi, go ahead.
Hi. Comment and a question. The comment is, I think every joint replacement patient should look up the infection, post-infection rates of the hospitals that the surgeons use. It varies quite a bit around Wisconsin. My question is, there the newer anterior approach versus the older posterior approach to total hip replacement makes a huge difference for athletes. Wonder if you could explain the two.
Certainly. If you don't mind, let me just touch on your first point. I definitely agree that patients, when deciding where or who to have do their operation, should really do their background research into the facility, into the provider, and make sure that they're comfortable with that facility. Because there, like any operation that we do, there are potential complications and risks, and you as the patient need to be comfortable with that location you're having that surgery done in and with the provider you're having do it. And then to go to your question, Saul, there are a number of ways to do or perform hip replacement surgery, and what you referred to as the anterior versus a more standard lateral or side-based approach. Those types of approaches have been around for quite some time. The decision-making point about how or which approach to use is really based off of surgeons' experience with one or the other. Just like I mentioned, you want to make sure that your surgeon is experienced in doing that approach and gets good outcomes with that. In the long run, studies have shown that a hip replacement done either through a more standard side approach versus a anterior approach can have the same outcomes. However, to your point, some studies have shown maybe a slightly faster recovery with an anterior approach compared to a more laterally based approach. And for the viewers that may not know anything about that, really from an anterior approach, you're moving muscles aside and not really cutting them that you sometimes have to do through a laterally based approach. Again, in the long run, the same outcomes based off of larger studies, but in the short term, it certainly can provide a little bit better recovery for patients.
What is your approach in the operating room?
I primarily do an anterior approach, but I perform hip surgery through three different approaches depending on various factors. And I think this is important. If somebody, every patient is different, and there are various reasons why I may need to choose a different approach because I feel like I can do that operation safer for a patient that way. Sometimes patients have had surgery as a child and they have different anatomy or implants that may be in there, and that requires a different approach. So not one approach can help and address all problems. And so I think that's the most important aspect, is that if you only do it one way, you certainly can have a difficult problem or difficult time doing it in certain manners. So, but I primarily do an anterior approach just because of the reasons that I mentioned before.
Okay, staying on the hip here, Steve now in Waterford. Hi, Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, guys. I just wanted to relate to you that in my 60s, I'm 73 now, but about 65 years of age, I had both hips replaced totally. I did the anterior approach, and I can tell you that I went in with excruciating pain where I couldn't even walk from, you know, around the kitchen without holding onto the cupboards or the countertops, and really affected my life. But when I had the surgery done, I went in on a Thursday morning around 7:30, had the surgery at 11:30. At 4:30 in the afternoon, I was walking with a walker around the hospital corridors. Friday, I stayed just for routine, you know, cleanup and getting, you know, everything checked out. And Saturday morning, I drove my truck home from the hospital. And I had absolutely zero pain. Matter of fact, I was more worried about removing the staples in the future than I was with pain. And I have been totally pain-free, or even, you know, even noticing anything in my hips for the last 10 years.
Wow. Steve, thank you for sharing your story. Steve, having a total change of life here through the surgeries.
Yeah. And what we find with hips, as I mentioned with knees, you know, knees, 85 to 90% of patients have an extremely or very good outcome. Hips, it's more of like 95 to 98%. So it's a very successful operation. And I'm glad that he had such a fast and good recovery, because, I mean, that is what we want for our patients. And that is what we see most of the time with these operations when they're performed well.
What are the risks or complications that occur or can occur that are opposite of what Steve experienced?
Well, as I believe Saul was the prior listener, I mean, infection is obviously our biggest concern in trying to manage and make sure that patients don't have any sort of surgical site infection or wound healing problem. With any sort of joint surgery, we're always concerned about a blood clot, whether in the leg or into the lungs. I do think that our ability to get people up faster and move more normally has decreased that, but still we treat patients with some sort of a medicine to minimize that risk. The blood loss from these operations has gone down significantly with medications over the last decade or two, and so minimizing the need for transfusions. There are other issues such as the ball popping out of the socket called dislocation that patients may hear about. That also has gone down with different techniques, both from the approach or the ways in which we repair and the implant. So those are the biggest things that we typically talk with patients about afterward or beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Webb, along the lines of obesity, Tear 2 from Ironwood, Michigan called, couldn't stay with us. Tear 2 wants to know if there is a weight limit for people to receive joint surgery. And along those same lines, Jim from Cedarburg emailed, wants to know recommendations on these joint surgeries for a person experiencing bone-on-bone pain who is morbidly obese. What would you say there?
Certainly all types of patients, whether, you know, they have medical issues, whether they're cardiac or pulmonary or obesity being one of their potential medical issues, still have bone on bone or osteoarthritic pain and need to have these addressed or potentially need to have these addressed. Morbid obesity or patients that have significant weight, it's not that hip surgery cannot be beneficial for them or cannot be performed. It's more of trying to manage the potential complications, because patients, just like surgeons, want to have as good of an outcome for these operations. And obesity can increase the potential risk of wound healing, infection, or malpositioning of implants. And so that's a discussion with the individual surgeon that you have as to whether or not you'd be a candidate based off of different weight criteria. A lot of surgeons will have certain cutoffs. Some surgeons don't. These are things that you have to kind of discuss more specifically with your individual surgeon. But in general, weight does increase your risk of complications. And that's why it becomes a factor when we're making the decision about proceeding.
Conversely, you know, if someone is able to lose a lot of weight and not be morbidly obese or not be obese, what impact does that have on these joints?
Well, it certainly can make the operation safer and it can make the outcomes more predictable. And in the long run, just like the prior caller was talking about running on their hip replacement, weight, whether you're running or whether it's obesity, can potentially wear these implants out faster. And so if your weight is in a more reasonable area, that can certainly improve the longevity of the implants that you have and potentially never need anything done the rest of your life.
Dr. Jonathan Webb, an orthopedic surgeon in Eau Claire, fielding all questions about hip and knee replacement surgeries, his experience in the area of revision surgery, orthopedic trauma, osteoarthritis. Still time to talk about your knee and hip joints, what to expect from surgery, your experiences, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Webb here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with orthopedic surgeon Jonathan Webb of Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire as we talk about hip and knee replacement surgeries. Dr. Webb with us for about 9 more minutes. Tim is joining us from Madison. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Hi. I had a bad case of Osgood Slaughter. So I went in the doctor when I was 50. he said he was able to remove it, wasn't tied to anything. So he turned me over to the surgeon. So I go into the surgeon to get the operation done. The guy's looking at the two nurses, rubbing his hands, saying, "Tie me. I think I can get this done in less than a half an hour." And when I came to, the guy had stapled, because they had to cut my where my kneecap is. They had to cut all that open, and he stapled right over the kneecap. At the time, I was talking to a girl from Marseille who worked for, was a secretary for one of the best knee surgeons over in Europe, and she was absolutely horrified at what she had seen. And it left a pretty wicked scar. So I don't know if this is a for-profit thing, how many other surgeries these guys can jam through, how much money they make, but I was not happy.
Tim, thank you. What, Dr. Webb, is the approach of staples in this surgery?
Yeah, so that's a great point, Tim. And I, you know, on behalf of everybody, I'm sorry that that was your experience of any sort of orthopedic surgery or any surgery in general. I mean, it's not, and it shouldn't be something where we are rushing to get through what we're doing. Our goal should be always focused on doing what's best for you as the patient, whether that takes 10 minutes to do or whether it takes 2 hours to do. The operation in which he's referring to is removing a prominence around one of the tendons about the knee, does at times require removing or elevating one of the tendons and having to put it back down. And so that staple was used, I would imagine, and again, I don't know the specific circumstance, to try to hold that tendon back down. But be that as it may, it really goes back to the fact that the experience of surgery, regardless of your outcome or regardless of how it's done, is an important aspect for a patient. We do these all day long, you know, most days of the week, and it's important for you as the patient, who this may be the only operation you ever have, to have a good experience to the best of our ability. And that goes from your initial interactions with our team to the day of surgery and to the follow-up. And so, you know, I hope that any sort of procedures or things like that you may need to be done in the future are much smoother for you. That certainly is an experience that you clearly are not going to forget, and for the wrong reasons.
I want to step back here and talk about the medical devices, the parts you need for these surgeries. And we've seen certainly huge worldwide supply chain issues in the pandemic. Have you been able to have access to the medical devices you need for these procedures on time when you need them?
That's a great question, given the current climate. But yes, I have not been aware of any sort of issues with supply chain of getting these implants to where they need to be during the entire pandemic, which has been great. Obviously, that takes a lot of coordination from the companies, the hospitals, the clinics, to make sure that we have what patients need on time. But it is essential that we have all of the tools and all of the implants that are necessary to do our job the right way. And luckily, we have not run into significant issues with that.
Have you been dealing with a backlog at all of surgeries? Because, of course, you know, at the start of the pandemic, all the surgeries were, you know, were either stopped or only surgeries that were needed absolutely imperative and immediately. Have you felt a backlog at all?
I think most providers, and going to our national meetings, I think that this is where most of the orthopedic surgeons across the country are, is that we, yes, in 2020 and early 2021, probably had a backlog of patients that we were needing to get to that didn't have emergent issues that were having to be put off because of the pandemic. I think our biggest issue now is making sure that patients feel safe and comfortable coming to these facilities that we work out of and have these problems taken care of. I mean, we hear a lot about the imperative or the important nature of making sure that patients that have cardiac, pulmonary, or neurologic issues are being seen and not afraid to be seen. Orthopedic issues are the same. We want patients to feel comfortable, to feel safe in our facilities. I think, you know, most providers around the country are doing the best that we can to make our clinics, our hospitals, our surgery centers as safe as they can be for patients to not have to worry about the pandemic or coronavirus as an issue in getting their, their operations. So hopefully they can not delay their lives any further and can kind of get that next step going in their life.
Let's bring in Lisa in Spring Green with a question. Lisa, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I had a total hip replacement on my right hip in 2014 when I was 64. And I had a fabulous outcome, just absolutely. It was life-changing because I was in a lot of pain for like 15 years. But anyway, my question is I'd like to hear your opinion about prophylactic use of antibiotics when you have to, you know, have dental procedures.
Lisa, thank you.
That's a great question. It's a very, at times, controversial one. And really, the Academy of Orthopedic Surgery has not put out any sort of specific recommendations and has left this up to the individual surgeons. The idea is that there can be some increased blood flow to an area after hip or knee surgery, and that when you're having dental procedures done, there is a short-term period where there can be bacteria released into your bloodstream that usually our bodies can manage, but we don't want those to kind of get stuck or around your implants, requiring any more surgery to that side. And so some people and some surgeons will do short-term antibiotic prophylaxis afterward, midterm, or even long-term. And I would really just have you discuss that with your individual surgeon.
What type of anesthesia is used for these procedures itself?
We typically use two different types of anesthesia, either a general anesthetic, which you know most people know about, which is where there's a tube placed into your breathing tube in order for you to kind of breathe during the operation, or a spinal anesthetic where there's a short-term numbing medicine injected into the back that allows the legs to go numb for a couple of hours and allow us to do our procedure. There's also block anesthesias that can be utilized for knee surgery to minimize some of the pain afterward, but the two main forms are general and spinal anesthesia. There are pros and cons to both, and some of those can be related to a patient's underlying health issues, but certainly we are seeing a trend towards more spinal anesthesia being done across the country for various benefits that studies have shown.
We only have a few seconds left, but we're seeing that these types of surgeries are going to become more and more common, more across ages and gender. Is the profession, the orthopedic profession, prepared for this?
That's a great question. And we're working at making sure that we are training our trainees and getting more trainees through to try to offload what we know is going to be coming down the pipe. But yes, we are doing more and more of these operations because we want more and more patients to have the benefit from this as we're seeing arthritis become an issue as patients get older and more active in their younger years. So that's going to be seen, but we are working as a profession to make sure that we can keep up with the workload.
Dr. Webb, thank you for joining us.
Thank you all, and thank all of your listeners.
Dr. Jonathan Webb is an orthopedic surgeon at Mayo Clinic Health System in Eau Claire. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show is produced by Courtney Everett, Trevor Hook, Mackenzie Crummy, Clara Nypert, Joel Patnod, Royce Padeswa, and Joe Tarr. Our technical director is Maria Lopez. Keegan Kyle is interim executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us next for 1A here on the Ideas Network.